This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
It's an honor to welcome live in studio James Hilton. He's a vice president at the University of Virginia, the chief information officer. Thank you for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
I know you're very busy, and we appreciate your time. Been looking forward to it. We're going to talk about technology in the classroom, how technology is reshaping learning in America, and the whole idea of what we think of as a school is being transformed, and we're going to see that happen in our lifetime. And it's actually very exciting, a little scary, and let's talk about that. Let's start, though, James, with a James Hilton 101, where you're from, and how you ended up in Charlottesville.
Well, I'd be happy to tell you. It's a pleasure to be here. I have an unusual background for a chief information officer. Lots of times people say, what is the chief information officer? Essentially, the chief information officer, my role is to help guide technology strategy across the university. But I'm actually a social psychologist by training. I was an undergraduate at the University of Tech, grew up in the mountains of Western North Carolina, then was an undergraduate at the University of Texas, a graduate student at Princeton, joined the faculty at the University of Michigan in 1985, was on the faculty there through the ranks of junior, associate, full professor, and taught a variety of courses that ranged in size from small seminars of 12 people to introductory psychology classes where I had 1,200 students and 30 graduate student teaching assistants.
Oh, my gosh.
I used to say, people would say, how do you do that? And I'd say, well, you just have to plan it really well. One thing about an intro-psych course is it's as spontaneous as a shuttle launch.
Yeah.
I was also the undergraduate chair. And after I'd been at Michigan for about 12 years, I started working. When I started to take on the introductory psychology class, I had taught lots of large classes before. But what I was really struck by was this: was the modal student in an intro-psych class in the fall as a first semester student. My class is bigger than many of their high schools. I suppose it was a sign of my own aging, but I was struck by how young they always looked. and how their habits differed from my habits. So they were much more connected. They were already using email, which they now barely use, but at the time they were using email, and cell phones were already starting to dominate. And I started thinking about how to reach out and connect with students in the context of a large lecture class and how to actually make the lecture more useful to them than just me sitting up and droning. So I started working with a bunch of folks at Michigan who help faculty with technology in the classroom to try to find ways. So it sounds very mundane now, but at the time it was cutting edge to put your lectures into PowerPoint, to make those slides available. The really radical notion was to make those slides available before students came to class. Set up practice exams on the web, and to provide email as a way of connecting both with me and with each other.
So you were right there at the forefront in the classroom as this stuff was becoming available, email, PowerPoint, and you're putting it to use and experimenting with it.
I was. The biggest problem was getting a projector that was bright enough to shine in the lecture hall at that time. It was about the size of a Volkswagen. And at the same time, I also started working with a colleague from West Virginia on a multimedia project with a publisher. The idea was to make as many of the great ideas in psychology as possible interactive, to allow people, for example, if they want to understand visual illusions, to give them experience with visual illusions and give them interactive experiences that we hope help them explain how they work better. And I also was the undergraduate chair for the psychology department at the time, and I was very cognizant of the fact that I was introducing all this technology into what was the first gateway course in the department, and that many of my colleagues might not see that as such a wonderful thing when those students showed up in their classes with similar expectations. So I wrote a grant proposal to basically start creating a library of digital assets that people could use, tools that faculty could use in their classes subsequently. My sort of notion was, you know, in preparing for intro psych lectures, this was before you could just go on the web and do a Google image search.
Yeah.
So getting access to images and media was
critical.
Yeah.
Was there a lot of pushback among your peers in the university when you were at Michigan? Folks who said, look, I've been teaching my course for decades the same way. I don't need PowerPoint. I don't need slides. I need a lectern.
There were skeptics. I wouldn't say that I got pushback in part because I got the grant to help them.
So, right.
So we were able to
provide
some
resources to help them.
So you
could put the money on the table, yeah.
Right. What they were mostly shocked by was the notion that I would make my slides and lecture notes available before I would give the lectures. They thought that would surely undermine attendance and disrupt the class. And for me—
Did it?
No, not at all. For me, in fact, what I encouraged the students to do was to go and look at the slides beforehand, print them off if they wanted to, bring them so that they could take notes on it, because we don't actually teach students how to take notes. So I don't think that
it's a good point,
poor
yeah.
note-taking skills should be held against them. It also made it much easier when people would say, well, I didn't get that definition, or that's not what you said. I actually could point back to the PowerPoint slides. And I found that it, and I think the other thing that faculty were really surprised by was a technology like email, which makes you in some ways much more available to students. They thought that with 1,200 students, I would drown with email. I actually found that it made life much more manageable. I had, when students would ask questions on email, they were forced to ask better questions. They couldn't just sort of show up and rely upon face-to-face niceness and say, I didn't really understand what you said in the lecture. Could you explain it again? Right? They would have to focus their questions. So they ask better questions, and I give better answers when I get to write them down and send them an email than I do just off the cuff.
Interesting.
And so those were interesting lessons, important lessons to learn. But we also I kept running into some problems, and I kept complaining about those problems. So for example, when I got the grant to create this library of digital objects, I was assured that I was free to create the digital library, but I couldn't be a test case for fair use under copyright law, which, without going into the details of it, the bottom line is if I had known then what I know now about copyright and fair use, I would have handed the check back. Because there's only one way to know whether or not your use is a fair use or not, and that's to have a judge tell you,
right,
yeah, that was a fair
court.
One or not, right? When I was doing the multimedia project with the publisher, the University of Michigan's intellectual property policies at the time said that faculty own scholarly works, but exempted from that software. And software you had to declare to the tech transfer office, and then they would decide who actually owned it. So I marched down to the tech transfer office, because this was all going to come on a CD-ROM when CD-ROMs were new and popular.
Yeah.
And they laughed at me. I disclosed it, and they laughed at me, and they said, it's not software. And I said, well, it's shiny disk. You need a computer to run it. It seems like software to me. And they said, well, I mean, to be sure, it's software, but it's not software. And
that's helpful.
I didn't find it so much. So I kept complaining and was eventually rewarded for my complaints, as universities often reward complainers, with a committee assignment. So I was charged by the vice president for research and the provost at Michigan to chair a committee that would essentially look at intellectual property challenges that new technology were bringing to the university.
Which has become a huge new field.
Very yeah. huge. Very huge. And very problematic.
Yeah, absolutely.
If anybody wants to do a web search for a really great video out there right now on intellectual property and education, Larry Lessig just gave a talk at EDUCAUSE, which is on the web, probably can find it with a quick search. That's spectacular. It's an hour-long talk. It's wonderful. But my committee basically looked at the intellectual property policies, looked at copyright law and some of the threats that it was providing to the academy, some of the challenges as more and more things fall under copyright. Issued a report that said faculty need help with this, envisioned the provost hiring a law school faculty member who would sort of half the time spend time helping faculty navigate it. But more importantly, the gist of the report said that there is this huge collision coming between university life and values and the legal framework that popular culture rides on, that intellectual property laws are being driven in the broad society largely by entertainment interests. So copyright, there is now, Jefferson actually, in talking about copyright and talking about ideas, you know, the real reason why copyright exists constitutionally is to provide an incentive for people to share their ideas. That what copyright protects is the expression of the idea, the way you say the idea.
Not the idea itself.
Not the idea itself. In fact, Jefferson argued that if nature had created anything that was resistant to the notion of pure property, it was this thing called an idea. Because once I tell you my idea, you cannot erase it from your mind. You can't make it go away. It's changed the way you think. And that's, in fact, how cultures and societies progress, are by the sharing of ideas. So ironically, copyright was an incentive to get people to share. But today,
it's used just the opposite.
Right,
yeah.
Ownership. It's about locking things down. So what we said is, and if you think about why universities exist, at their core, universities exist. All the investment that's made, tuition, research dollars, everything is made to create this enclave where people share their ideas, where they collaborate together to produce new knowledge. And so what happens if you have people coming from a popular culture, kids who are being told you can't take anything, you can't share anything, right? It's owned. What happens when those people show up in the university and they think our goal is to get people to share ideas, and they think job one is to protect their intellectual property? That if faculty and students start to think that protecting their intellectual property is job one, it's game, set, and match for universities.
Yeah.
And this committee basically said somebody ought to be thinking about that proactively.
Absolutely.
Rather than reactively.
Yeah, very. Lots of foresight there. We're talking with James Hilton. He's a vice president at the University of Virginia, the chief information officer. And of course, James, now you see a lot of the younger faculty folks who grew up with all this new technology. They come in thinking, hey, this is mine.
Right.
This is all mine. I got to protect my lecture. I got to protect it.
Well, some of them do. I mean, one of the good things that's happened over the last 5 to 7 years is a very healthy debate about ideas and ownership and open access versus closed proprietary access. I think the thing that I would say faculty and students all do need to know is you actually need to be more aware. You need to understand what your stake is in all these discussions about copyright and things that may not seem like they're relevant, like piracy of music. How does that relate to the progress of science? But I would say that there's a healthy debate and more people are aware of it. So to make a long story short, I met with the provost as the chair of that committee, and she said, love the report, not going to hire a new law school faculty member. How about instead I just hire you to work at it as a special project? And I did that for a year. It was the perfect job. Nobody reported to me. I had no clear deliverables. I could be in any meeting that I wanted to be in because I was from the office of the chief academic officer, but I had to be in no meetings. And then after that, about a year after I started that job, the CIO at Michigan stepped down, and I got a frequent administrator upgrade and became the associate provost for IT there. Did that for 4 years, largely because I could talk about technology in a way that resonated, I think, to the provost in terms of why technology is, in fact, important and strategic to the university, not just email and phone service and network capability.
It's absolutely critical and speaks to the very raw function, as you say, this sharing of ideas.
Right.
Technology is right there, reshaping, redefining, and remaking the university as we know it. And let's pick up with that when we get back. We're going to take a break now for local news and weather. We'll get an update on the situation out on Route 22, where that road has been closed due to a car carrier that has flipped over. We're talking with James Hilton. He's the chief information officer at the University of Virginia. This is Charlottesville Right Now. We're talking with James Hilton, chief information officer at UVA. James, before we went to a break, we were talking about this whole idea of technology really changing what happens in the classroom, how it happens, and the university at large. Explore that idea a little bit of what's really happening now.
Sure. I think that you can think about technology changing things in two different ways. On my good days, I think about the pull. So one of the very cool things that technology is doing right now is I like to say it's changing the fabric of inquiry. So it's changing the way new knowledge is being discovered, the ability to deal with enormous data sets, to simulate things that you can't see. So John Hawley, for example, simulates gravitational fields around black holes. You can't just go out and in real time manipulate gravity, but you can simulate it and you can come up with new models and you can guide what astronomers should be looking for to confirm whether or not it's true. Even in the humanities, at some level, what humanities really is about is a sustained conversation that takes place over time in published articles. And technology is changing that. It's shifting to blogs and wikis, and it's becoming much more dynamic and accelerating. So the fabric of inquiry is changing, and that's exciting. But the other side of technology is that if there is a single truth about technology, it is that in any information-intensive endeavor, anything that's information dependent, technology tends to disrupt it. And by disrupt it, I mean change it in ways that render it unrecognizable. So think about banking. When I was a kid and you wanted to go and you did your banking, first off, you did banking basically only on Saturdays because banks were only open from about 9:30 to 3:30 on weekdays. And I would go with my father, and you would stand in line, and there would be tons of tellers around, and you'd see the whole neighborhood, and it was quite the social event.
You talk to a person.
And you would talk to a person. Yeah, the only way to get anything done was to talk to a person. And after all that was done, because I grew up in the South, we'd go out for barbecue. Today, right, I do all of my banking online. If I actually need cash, which I hardly ever need, but if I actually need cash, I go to an automated teller. And I get ticked off if it takes more than 30 seconds for me to make it through, right? So it's completely changed the dynamics of that. If you look at the challenges that the music industry and the publishing industry have right now, while the music industry is concerned about piracy, at some level, their real problem is that technology has come in and it's unbundled their business model in traditionally through every technological revolution before, from wax to LPs to cassettes to, God help us, 8-track tapes to CDs, right? The basic business model was the same. You bundle a bunch of songs, some of which are going to be good, where good is just defined as profitable. People will pay for it. And some of them are going to be bad. People aren't going to like them and they aren't going to want to buy them. But you bundle them together in an album and you sell the album. You release a couple of singles to push the album and you make your sales off of the albums. And along comes technology, and it unbundles that business model. It makes it possible for you to buy single songs rather than albums. And so you see the music industry sort of agonizing over how much should they charge for a song. Well, think about those same kinds of pressures in higher education. A higher education at major universities are highly bundled. You pay tuition and housing, and with that you get community, you get food, you get entertainment, you get libraries, you get a whole host of resources that are all bundled together in a single thing. And technology comes along, and again, in every other information-intensive endeavor that it's touched, it unbundles, it disrupts. And I think higher education over the next 20 or 30 years is going to go through that. In 2007, online education grew 12.2%.
In 1 year.
In 1 year. Higher education as a whole grew 1.2%. So one of the things that I start to think about is what happens as increasingly people look at online education, not just as a viable alternative, but what happens as online education, in fact, becomes the new norm. What does that do for residential-based education? And depending on where you are, again, part of what unbundling does is it causes markets and people to have to think carefully about strategically what are they going to do in this new place. That one of the things that happens when it unbundles things is that different kinds of institutions are going to face different pressures. If you're an institution where convenience is the main thing that drives students to you, so you're a local community college, right? You're there primarily because you're close and available. Online education is a huge and immediate threat. If you're a place like UVA, I actually think online education is a threat over the long haul, and I actually think of it more as an opportunity, because what it gives you the opportunity to do is to say, you know, UVA, one of the things that I love about Virginia, I've been here 3.5 years now, and one of the things that I love about UVA is this place is deeply, the university is deeply connected to place. Once you've been here, you really do understand that UVA could not have been born out of sight of Monticello. So physical place still matters, and it's going to continue to matter in the future. The challenge for a place like UVA is, how do we use technology to enhance the strategic value of a face-to-face residential education? Not how do we just avoid the threat, but how do we in fact use it in ways that that make face-to-face truly a strategic advantage?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the fun problem.
We're talking with James Hilton. He is the Chief Information Officer at the University of Virginia. I remember reading somewhere, James, I think it was the Post or something a few weeks ago, that there was somebody saying long-distance education is going to ruin the universities of the future. There are going to be all these big empty buildings. But as you point out, a place like UVA will always have a real value to it being here on these grounds, these historic grounds, designed and planned and built by Thomas Jefferson. That will always be a rich, valuable experience, right?
Sure, it will be. And what I'm interested in is then how can you push it further? So one of the things that got me when I was teaching this intro psych class with 1,200 people was that if you ask me, is there one thing in life that you know you do well unambiguously, right? Most things I have doubts about, but I know that I can teach an intro psych class. And I can teach it in ways that students show up, they're engaged, I give real exams and I get real scores from them. And it was a wonderful thing and I loved teaching it. But I would go home and I would say to my wife, you know, I feel like I am the fastest telegraph operator in the room. And there's this thing starting to ring over in the corner and it's called a phone and it's going to blow it away. And I really started thinking about how does technology, you know, lectures, the kinds of information that are passed through in lectures are easily captured by technology,
yeah,
podcasting. So the challenge, if I step back into that class today, my challenge would be, how do I assign the podcast as the prep work, as the homework? My old lecture now becomes the base.
Yeah.
And how do I now find ways to use this precious resource face-to-face that we have to use it in ways that add way more value than just giving the lecture. And it's through things like conversation. It's through things like joint projects, joint quests. You know, if you ask me, one of the things that's going to happen is places like UVA, the undergraduate curriculum is going to increasingly focus on knowledge discovery, not mastery of content. Mastery of content will lend itself well to technology. But the quest for the discovery of new information, finding ways to get undergraduates involved in research, building teams, using technology to connect those teams with faculty so that you can scale it, that's what the promise is.
Yeah. We're talking with James Hilton, Chief Information Officer for the University of Virginia. I'm reminded of the fact that my wife is on the faculty at Washington and Lee. It's a much smaller community, and there, even when she was an undergraduate back in the 80s, there was always a huge emphasis that you're not just here to hear lectures. We want students to participate in research with the professors. And she said that was the best part of the experience for her, was being looked at as a freshman and saying, join our team, help us do research.
Right. And I think that the opportunity is to make that increasingly not the prize, but the norm.
Interesting. Right? Yeah. That this is what you do.
Right. Right. You are part of our community, and our community is jointly engaged in this quest for new knowledge.
So the undergraduate experience of the future will look much more like what you and I growing up recognized as the graduate level experience in many ways.
I think so. At premier, especially research-based universities, it's going to have to. Because I think in the absence of that, again, what happens when the majority of people actually complete their higher education degrees online? How does that change the way they think about the value proposition of a residential-based education? And
You got to offer them something more, yeah.
Right, and I would like to believe we'll offer them something more than the former Paul Courant, the provost at Michigan, said. You know, there are always going to be places like Michigan and UVA are always going to be. We will always have students who are willing to come here. He said because you know for late adolescent youth, there are really three places where they finish growing up. They either do it in the military, in prison, or in universities, and we're the best return on investment. But I think we can aspire for more than that.
Yeah, yeah. And as this conversation is pointing out, technology is going to be right there, the hub of the wheel of this whole transformation.
Right. Technology is both the thing that I think is disrupting it, and it offers solutions. So what really happens is technology first comes in, it unbundles, it disrupts, and then it gets repackaged. People find new ways to use the tools. So right now, web pages look pretty much like books looked. But Web 2.0 and Web 3.0, which really engage interactivity and really involve production. Like one of the great things that I find interesting, I have a daughter who's 18 and a son who's 21. And if you tell them to go write a term paper, they roll their eyes. But in fact, both of them are writing all the time. They're writing in blogs. They're writing on Facebook. And that is a form of publishing. It's not the kind of publishing that academics do, but it is this publishing creative expression. And I look at that and I go, we have to find ways to harness that energy, find ways to turn that into the quest again for new knowledge.
Yeah. So that you're participating in the university community. You might be a lot of blogging and conversation on listservs and talking.
And in fact, we're rolling out over the next 3 to 4 months, we're going to be rolling out tools as part of our technology environment, the course management system. We're going to be rolling out blogging tools, wiki tools, video editing, and display tools. So we are trying to provide the infrastructure that enables that to happen.
Yeah. And so much of this, we're talking with James Hilton of the University of Virginia, Chief Information Officer. So much of this, James, really falls down on the teacher, the professor in the classroom. They're going to really have to think a lot more now just than their subject matter. Right. They have to really think outside the box and reach out to you and your team and say, help me take this university into the 21st century.
Right. And so the thing that I think is really exciting about these tools that we're about to roll out is they were all picked by a faculty group. This was not a case where the technologist came in and said, oh, we've been looking at this technology that you guys need, and we really think you should either have this version of a blog or this version of a blog. Instead, a group of faculty got together and said, what are the tools that we need to make scholarship and teaching go to the next level? And then they came to us and said, can you support these? So it's kind of the reverse process of the normal, boy, I'm a technologist and I got great solutions for you. You're going to love it.
Right. They're pulling it in.
Right.
James Hilton is a vice president at the University of Virginia, chief information officer, and part of the team that is reshaping and remaking the university of the future. It's very, very exciting. Before we let you go, I'm curious, what's the biggest challenge right now? Is it the folks who just don't want change? Because that's always going to be there, I guess.
I think the biggest change with technology always is people don't. It is hard to comprehend the real pace of change with technology and how you plan for and try to stay ahead of that change. So just a little factoid. In 1996, if you wanted a terabyte of data storage, spinning disk, not that anybody would think about a terabyte in 1996,
but
if you thought about it, it would cost you $1 million. You can buy that terabyte now at Best Buy for under $100. That's the pace of change.
Wow.
So how do you prepare for that world? How do you prepare for a world where people bring consumer devices in and they want to use them? They don't want to use the computers we give them. They want to use the computers they bring with them. They want to use the PDAs they bring with them. They want to use the software that they can get out on the web without going through us. How do you manage in that environment? That's the biggest challenge, I think.
James Hilton, Chief Information Officer at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much for coming in. Fascinating stuff. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.